Hi, I'm Aurelius.
And I'm Katrina.
And this is Home Team.
In this episode, we talk about Are Prisons Obsolete by Angela Y. Davis and play a microgame. Okay. Hi, y'all. This book, Are Prisons Obsolete, is very short, and it is essentially an answer to the question of the title, and the answer is yes.
Yes, indeed.
That's the book.
That's the podcast, y'all. The answer is yes.
Angela Davis goes into lots of different things about what prisons are for, kind of how prisons developed, how prisons are very connected to capitalism and the development of capitalism as a racial and economic system, how prisons are gendered, and then gives us some things to think about in terms of how we think about abolition.
Yes, yes. And if you don't know the legend, the GOAT, I won't say the GOAT, a GOAT, okay, of abolition, Angela Y. Davis. She is the author of this book. I think Angela Davis's brilliance is in the reality that she is a scholar, but she came to scholarship through her own activism and engagement with radical movements in the 60s and 70s and in her upbringing in Alabama during a heightened period of white supremacy and white supremacist violence in Alabama. And so much of her research and work revolves around her own lived experience and actually being targeted by the state and being incarcerated for some time, which she talks about in this book, and actually coming on the outside of that because of a movement, an outcry to Free Angela Davis. You'll probably see Black woman with a big afro, those Free Angela Davis shirts, they still circulate in the woke movement, woke apparel movement. That's Angela Davis. And so I think what's really cool about her is that, like, she's a brilliant scholar, but also, like, she embodies that study and struggle that she also, like, struggles and engages in activism and organizing and has for so long in relation to the Communist Party, as well as the Black Panther Party, which she was affiliated with many members of the Black Panther Party, and a leading figure in the feminist movement as well. So I'm a big fan.
And she is, like, the person who started popularizing prison abolition as, like, a thing that we can now talk about in the U.S.
For sure.
Since we're talking about abolition, spoiler alert, that's how this book ends. Let's really quickly define it.
Abolition is a political vision and a practical organizing strategy working to dismantle the prison industrial complex, which Angela Davis gets into what the prison industrial complex is, who first sort of coined the term off of the military industrial complex. Abolition is also about building up the structures in the society where prisons are fully obsolete, where prisons are fully no longer needed as a response to social problems. And not just prisons. What she talks about with the prison industrial complex is all of the various systems and private corporations that are bound up with the prison system as a whole. So that is what we're working to abolish and working to build up.
Yeah. She also reminds us that this is about fixing a series of relations between things. So it is both, like, interpersonal, it is economic, it is social, it is structural, it is all of these different things, where we just get to make a world where prisons are no longer needed. And I really liked how she ends this book with a, like, really concrete example of what that can look like, talking about the Beale family.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting, that ending, because she's talking about the last chapter's abolitionist alternatives, and she's talking about lots of different alternatives, that there's not one single fix, as the prison has become a one single fix to all of these various issues, but she is specifically talking about a justice system that focuses on repair and restorative justice, and talks about a specific example of that happening in apartheid South Africa.
Yeah. Okay, if you didn't get to read the rest of the book, we're going to talk about some of the main points now.
Yeah, so we've already essentially talked about the main point of the book, which is to answer this question, are prisons obsolete? I think Angela Davis, she does a really good job of like asking questions. And then throughout the chapter where she asks those questions, she provides answers to them. And I think one of the biggest takeaways and like main points of the book is like the historical perspective. And so in the first chapter, prison reform or prison abolition, and in the second one, when she's talking about civil rights and segregation, she's talking about other abolitionist movements and that like the abolition of prisons isn't new, right? Like working to abolish racist institutions is not new. And she talks about the history of slavery and how that is bound up with the prison and the prison system. She talks about segregation and she talks about lynching and how each of these institutions were at one time or another viewed as sort of necessary pillars of our society, of American society, and how it took people like Frederick Douglass, people like Ida B. Wells, to say, this needs to be abolished. This is something that doesn't serve us, right? And to fight against the powers that be, if you will, to abolish it. And so I think that's a really major point in this book is that abolition is not new, right? There have been lots and lots of people and movements that have pushed for abolition for generations, especially in the Black radical tradition.
Which is what we're here talking about.
Yeah.
One of the things that also comes up in a lot of the same places as what you're talking about is that prisons actually were the reform strategy from like capital punishment, which we still do in conjunction with prisons, and more like a torturous form of punishment. She cites Foucault's Discipline and Punish, which if you're interested and want to read something that is difficult, feel free to read that on your own time. A through line of this book is that reform is just simply not a sufficient strategy for dealing with the historical legacies of incarceration and the present moment, especially in the context of the prison industrial complex.
So yeah, let's define the prison industrial complex.
So this is a term that Mike Davis first used in an article that I believe is called Factories in the Hell Field, that is about how we can think about prisons in a context related to military and industry. And so this is a term that is more suited to describing kind of the present long moment of the prison. It is not necessarily applicable to kind of the beginning forms of penitentiaries. And it's kind of specifically talking about this broad intertwining of incarceration with global capitalism.
And I think it's a really useful term because even if you don't know or haven't heard like industrial complex before, you know that like it expands prisons, right? So that like it's not just the physical buildings, right? But that it's this huge web of private interest with public interest that are bound up in capital and bound up in the creation and prison boom of what we now know as like mass incarceration and the war on drugs and all of this. Like all of that was bound up in public legislation, but also people that were benefiting from people being incarcerated, from people getting arrested, so on and so forth.
Yeah. And that goes all the way back to abolition of slavery with the convict leasing system. Prisons are like fundamentally about controlling labor and especially Black people's labor.
Well, I love that she hits on that, right? And like Angela Davis, she's a Marxist, so like it makes sense. But I love the connections because I do think that like the labor movement and when we think of like workers' rights today, it has become, in the broader perspective from my lens, like a white workers issue. When in reality, like so many of exploited people and exploited workers throughout America's history have been Black folks and have been like the formerly enslaved people who are descendants of enslaved folks. And I love that she sort of brings that out in this book, right? That like the prison was a reform and the prison boom was an answer to a lost labor class. That was what slaves were. And so, yeah, the convict leasing system into prisons became like a replacement for that labor class. And I think that is like one of the strongest arguments for like, okay, if you agree that slavery shouldn't exist and that slavery is a racist system, if you agree that lynching is terrible and inhumane and was racist and targeted and unjust, right? And if you believe that racism should not dominate how our systems interplay with society, then you should agree, right, that prisons should not exist because there's literally a direct tie to people who were emancipated in 1865. Certain laws were changed. The black codes were created to then criminalize those formerly enslaved people. And they were put back many times on the very same plantations that they were just freed from to now work under this convict leasing system. So you literally have slavery under another name, which is another book.
What you were talking about with the reformulation of labor strategy and practices and how that is such a white person's thing now. W.E.B. Du Bois writes about that in Black Reconstruction and how important it was for Black people to be involved in like leading labor movements and how one of the like fundamental reasons we ended up with convict leasing was because white people would not have solidarity with formerly enslaved Black workers because they were not able to get over the precarity of their own position in relation to Black workers. So it's very important. I think maybe we should also talk about racialization, which Angela Davis does not technically touch on a ton, but I think is important in this context to talk about. Racialization is like the process by which racial categories are made. And the way that we talk about race presently in the United States generally does not account for that process and the inherent flexibility that that process has. We talk about racial categories as things that are that have always existed and things that are somewhat stable. And that is simply not the case. And one of the things that we will encounter over the coming books is that this is a process that is shifting and is very related to criminalization and the determination of who can be exploited as a racial class.
Yeah. And it almost becomes and has become an interchangeable word. Like you can use criminal with black or you can use criminal with native or with Latino or, you know, immigrant or what have you today. And yeah, I think that's really, really key for the argument that many of these books that we're diving into make, but especially this one around Are Prisons Obsolete? And one of the things that I love that she tackles in this book is like prison writers, folks who are incarcerated, mm-hmm. who are like writing, and how that is a part of the struggle against prisons and to really popularize what she calls like the anti-prison movement. And so like a really popular example is Malcolm X, who folks likely know as like a very big civil rights leader, maybe don't know as somebody who very fiercely like educated himself while he was incarcerated and was somebody who wrote, right, really, really powerfully about the powerful tool of education. And she talks about others, Assata Shakur. She quotes at the beginning of the chapter on how gender structures the prison, a woman who's incarcerated. She talks about Mumia, who's one of the biggest sort of prison abolition activists and organizers who's incarcerated, wrote Live from Death Row, things of that nature. And I just think that's really, really powerful that Angela Davis is doing that as somebody who was incarcerated, who was targeted by in the like middle of your freaking tough on crime. I mean, Ronald Reagan, Richard Nixon kind of stuff, right? Like, that's when she got incarcerated and she got out because of this movement. And so I think she's one of those prison writers, right, who she's talking about, but also like bringing in other examples of that as well.
Yeah, one of the articles that is going to be in our further reading section for this book is an article by Angela Davis written while she was in prison about Black women's role. It's called Black Women's Role in the Community of Slaves. And it's just very good, and it's so cool to think about how we can be more connected with people who are locked up and have solidarity in our organizing.
Another really big piece of this book to me is like the gender chapter. And like, it's a difficult chapter to read because like she's describing very graphic examples of how like routine practices within the prison are forms of gendered violence and forms of sexual assault, especially. But I also thought it was super interesting in this chapter specifically around like thinking about how crime, and this may not be a word, gets masculinized versus like put into the feminine, and how throughout history, crime was seen differently for people in women's prisons versus people in men's prisons, and people who get categorized in those two categories. And I thought that was super, super interesting. And also like that for a time, if a woman committed a crime, that was seen as like masculine. And so her punishment was to be domesticated, essentially, to be taught how to be a quote unquote proper woman. Like it's just like really, really interesting to think about and how that has changed over time. And then also how like, okay, women who have committed crimes are now the worst, right? Because like they're doing this really masculine thing, and they must be punished even harsher for it in these women's prisons.
Yeah, this chapter was a hard read. One of the things that stuck out to me too was the role of eugenics in all of this, and how women in like betraying this feminine role were sometimes not, you know, criminalized like you're talking about, but said they were crazy, and so they were institutionalized, which served the goal of making sure they couldn't reproduce.
And yeah, connecting like as a part of this prison industrial complex, like psychiatric institutions with, you know, where people are forced to stay but don't technically have like a prison sentence.
Something that academics get really hung up on is the different types of incarceration, which I find not particularly useful because it's all working out of the same like racial capitalist system. And a thing that I like that she did was explicitly mentioned, like psychiatric institutionalization and ICE detention, because these are all fruits of the same tree, if you will.
Yeah.
Should we real quick define criminalization? One of the things that she does in here is talk about how a part of abolition is delinking crime and punishment.
What has gotten criminalized and what has been deemed needed to be punished has changed quite a lot over time in racialized and gendered ways. And I think a major, major point for me around abolition just in general, and that she hits on in this book, is that like crime is not objective. Criminalization is not objective. It's not like some hard line of right and wrong. Because like you're saying, Katrina, like people do crimes all the time. They just aren't criminalized for it, right? Like that's the difference. Like if you are actually caught slash in a community that is hyper-policed and that much more likely to be caught for the quote unquote crimes that you commit. So like we got to stop talking about crime as if it demarks what is good and what is bad, because it's so much messier than that.
Yeah. And a thing that she is really explicit about is the way that crime and criminality have been used as stand-ins for race. I think is a really important thing that we are going to see over and over again as we continue reading. Let's do real quick one sentence takeaways from this book.
My takeaway from this book is that it is a very succinct but still comprehensive argument for abolition. from a historical, gendered, and racialized perspective.
This is kind of a favorite thing that is also a takeaway, is like the insistence that we can't talk about prisons without talking about capitalism.
Yes, yes.
Amazing. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with a micro game. Welcome back. Joining us, as always, is our game designer, Nate, here to explain what the heck we're doing.
Hey, y'all. Glad to be back. This week, we are playing a micro game called Are Blank Obsolete? And this is a buzzer-free micro game. So the way that this will work is I'm going to ask a question. I'm going to ask you, are blank obsolete? And you can respond either yes, meaning yes, it is obsolete, or no, no, it is not obsolete. And how I'm defining obsolete, we should get this out of the way, is that it is not in like mainstream purchasable and or like accessible. It is not accessible or purchasable in the way that it was at sort of the height of its adoption. So it's a little bit gray and it's a little bit like dependent on my sort of judgment, and that's going to stand here.
So what you're saying is that we can and should fight you.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. I think that would make for a really excellent and listenable podcast. So I'm going to ask you these questions. I'm going to determine the answer, and that will be what goes.
And, the issue here is that we are probably the two most competitive people.
That's for sure.
As a part of this group, so yep, this could get interesting.
Let's jump in. Are blank obsolete? Are VHS tapes obsolete?
My answer is yes.
I think based on the definition you gave us, that answer would be yes, because I don't think you can walk into a store and buy a VHS player anymore.
I like your judgment. You are both correct. The answer is yes. The last VHS players were produced in 2016 by Sanyo.
My gosh.
That's more recent than I thought.
Same here. I was like, whoa, that is a really recent production. Huh. Are telegraphs obsolete?
I mean, that's got to be a yes.
Yes.
You are both wrong. Telegraphs are not obsolete. And before we get all like up in a fight about this, because I know I said like,
is it the military?
I know I said like you could go into a store. I don't actually know if you can buy like a telegraph machine. But what I found in my research is that there are still 17 million telegraphs that are sent a year. And there are operational telegraph lines where you can still buy like the ability to transmit a telegram.
Like, how?
I think I just said telegraphs that are sent, but I meant telegrams. You get the point. I've never used one. I don't know the lingo.
They're obsolete to you.
Yeah. But yeah, no, there's still 17 million a year. And I do think it's like,
I'm shocked,
more like military and hobbyists. I think there are certain like weather applications as well, potentially. But yeah, they're still used. Okay.
I want to challenge that one. I'm not going to lie.
Well, you answered the same. So it's, you know, moot point. Moving forward.
We win together and we lose right together.
Are typewriters obsolete?
No.
I also think no, because there's like new kinds of typewriters being developed, I believe.
And that you is, can walk and also you can walk into any vintage store today for the most part and find a typewriter.
Okay, but that is a vintage store and not a like a new production store.
Yeah. That is an interesting, I'm gonna give you an opportunity to change your answer should you want to, if that is your basis, because I do mean like manufactured today, new, available. Like, are they obsolete or like?
Yes, they are obsolete.
Katrina?
What did I say?
You said no.
I said no, they're not obsolete. I mean, I feel like, are they not producing new types of typewriters?
I need a final answer.
Oh God. I'll say yes, they're obsolete and keep our solidarity.
Oh man, you both had it right. And then you both switched.
Well, you tricked us. This is bull, man. You're talking too much. You got to just say the question and that's it.
Okay. So there is a descendant of the company Royal, among others, that is still making like brand new typewriters to this day. And from what I read online, they are terrible.
That feels right.
Moving forward, Google Glass. Is Google Glass obsolete?
what's Google Glass?
Google Glass was introduced in 2012, and it is a wearable piece of technology that puts information on a screen in like a glasses-like device.
No.
Okay, so I know that people have like glasses with cameras on them. And I know that there is some sort of like facial recognition technology that is being incorporated into that in a pretty terrifying way.
I'm pretty sure Apple's making some glasses like this, or one of these brands for sure. And I imagine they're all just using the same glass because Google has a monopoly on everything. So, no.
I agree. I also say no.
So you're both saying no, it is not obsolete.
Correct.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but you're both sticking at one point. Google Glass was introduced in 2012. There was all this hype around it. They made people get like beta access to it via Twitter. And it was like so hyped up, and it was such a flop. And it was this like dumb little piece of glass that stuck out in front of your eyes, like sort of like glasses. Actually, Katrina, the funny thing about this is that when you and I worked at an IT technology store together, we had and wore these in the store. So you fully interacted.
I put these on.
You fully interacted with this product.
I have no recollection of that.
Sticking at one point, but also sticking with solidarity moving forward.
Ridiculous.
Are slide projectors obsolete?
No. Say something different than me. I said,
I feel like yes.
Okay. So here's the thing. Katrina has broken with Aurelius and fundamentally undermine solidarity, making Katrina a scab. But Katrina gets the point. They are, in fact, obsolete. And in my research, I found the last one was actually made in 2004, which is very similar to the VHS tape, like much more recent than I expected. Yeah. And there's a documentary about it called The Last Slide Projector.
Oh.
Wait. Maybe I'm misunderstanding what the slide projector is. You're talking about the things that pulled out that you are projecting.
No. That's different. A slide projector is like you have little film slides that you slide into the projector.
It's how people used to like look at their pictures at home. Next question. Pagers. Are pagers obsolete?
Yes, they are obsolete.
No, they're not obsolete.
Okay. Another point for the scab.
No.
The thing is, pagers are actually still used.
Doctors.
Very largely by doctors today. Because the doctors, like, they have these boundaries where they, like, don't want people to be able to text them and, like, them have to reply all the time, but they do have to be on call. And so.
You know, I should have known that. I should have thought that was a very common thing, very violent thing where pagers were used. So I should have known that. Okay.
Moving on. Dot matrix printers. And Aurelius, before you complain at me, I'm going to explain what they are.
Thank you. I'm like, God dang it.
Did you ever use one of those printers in your childhood that had the like paper on the side where you had to like, it had the like holes in the side of the paper?
It was foldy paper.
You had to like fold it and rip the sides of the paper off.
It was a stack. You know how you get post-its that are like attached on either side? So it's like a stack of post-its where the stick is on either side. It was paper that was like a long sheet of paper that was just folded in like an accordion.
Okay, so based on your experience with never having...
Right, I'm going to say no. I'm going to say yes, I mean.
Yes, it is obsolete?
Yes.
Here's my thing.
There's going to be like some weird profession that's still
I got a... like a heart test done a couple years ago, and I feel like maybe that was printed on dot matrix printers. So I'm going to say they're not obsolete.
Aurelius, I want to hear more about what you have to say about these weird professions that might still use this printer.
Okay, I'm going to say, wait, what did Katrina say?
I said I think that they are not obsolete.
Okay, I'm switching my answer to no.
Okay, that's a point for both of you. There's this weird profession called being in the government.
Oh.
That still uses 30-year-old technology.
I've never even seen this contraption.
Next question. Film SLR cameras.
Can you expand SLR?
SLR means single lens reflex. So it means a camera where there is a lens on the front that when you're looking through the camera, you are looking through the lens. And it's the most common type of film camera made like since the 60s.
No, they are not obsolete. My good people at Bedford still sell them.
I think I should know the answer to this. I think they are obsolete because, so I...
Nate, get my point.
I've purchased a new film camera, but what you're looking through is not looking through the lens. You're just looking through, like, the viewfinder. And I think that they make DSLRs, digital SLRs, but I think that maybe the new cameras do not, new film cameras. And I actually don't know how many new film cameras are in production.
Are you locking that in? Good to go?
I think yes.
Okay, so the thing is, Aurelius is going to get a point here.
Okay.
Because you are correct. You bought a rangefinder camera, but they do make SLRs today still.
Okay.
So that's the point for Aurelius.
It's shameful that I don't know the answer to that.
Well, I was going to say, you're giving a camera question to the photographer. It's wild.
I got it right. It's a photographer who doesn't pay attention to equipment and just takes photos.
Being Katrina's partner, I promise you, you are on equal footing for this game.
It's true.
Moving forward, the penultimate question. Is the clapper obsolete?
Explain. Oh. Feel like I haven't seen that since the Disney Channel show.
Yeah, I feel like yes, but I'm saying yes.
What's the score, Nate? Could this decide it?
You are currently down 1 point, so this could put you tied up.
I love the strategy.
I'm going to say no. I'm going to say like something that was cool to a lot of kids is probably still getting purchased.
This is an electric way to end the game because we are all tied up.
Yeah. Final question. Coming back, baby. Yes, sir.
Aurelius, make Katrina answer first.
But I can change my answer.
Final question. And this is for everything. Are iPods obsolete?
My knee jerk is yes.
I think also yes, because I think you and I had a conversation recently about how they're not making them, but I might have completely misremembered this.
Just so I'm not accused of cheating, I don't remember this conversation if it did happen.
Okay.
But the answer is yes, which makes you both winners.
Winners!
Participatory trophy.
Just like in any good leftist game, everyone's a winner.
Amen.
Everyone's a winner. Amen. When you're reading Angela Davis, okay?
Good game.
Good game, y'all.
Great game.
That's a baseball joke.
Boom.
Bonus question for you both. Is this game obsolete? And I think the answer is yes.
Yeah, we're probably not doing this one again.
No mas.
That was a book. That was a discussion. This was a game. And this has been...
Home team.